Good morning. It is great to see you. Welcome to MCC. My name is Josh. I'm one of the pastors here. And I forget things all the time. I'm really, really good at forgetting things. I don't even have to try to forget things. I forget things all the time. For example, you would not believe the number of Sundays that I lose my keys in this building somewhere. Almost every Sunday. Almost every Sunday. And they're laying right there right now. So if you see me frantic later, they're on the chair right there. But typically I'll come in, I'll have my keys, and I'll get busy, and I'll lay them down somewhere. And at the end of the day, I can't get in my office, and I can't get back in the building if I get out, because I can't find my car keys anywhere. About 2 months ago, they fell in somebody's purse. Somehow. It was my mother-in-law, and I was dropping our kids off. She was going to be with them one day, and she said, I found this set of keys in my purse, and I'd already had Kim make me a whole new set. Like, I lose everything all the time. One time, recently, in the last couple months, I forgot to get my allergy medicine refilled for 3 weeks straight. Like, I would drive around with the bottle in my car, like, go pick this up, and somehow I would forget it. You know why there's no chocolate muffins out there today? Because I was supposed to pick them up this week, and I totally forgot. I forget things all the time. I'm one of those people, I would literally lose my head if it weren't screwed on to my shoulders. I forget things all the time. I don't try to forget things. I don't, like, sit down and go, what can I forget today to make life as inconvenient as possible for the most people possible? I just have this natural sort of forgetfulness. I just forget things all the time. But you know what I don't forget? There are certain things I can't forget. I can forget my car keys, and I can forget to get my allergy medicine refilled. And there's this one time, actually, I was meeting Carla after work in Bowling Green, and I had all the kids and all that, and she's like, don't forget the diaper bag. And I'm almost to Bowling Green, and guess what I didn't have in the car? The diaper. So I'm really good at those sorts of things. But the things I can't forget when people have said things to me that are hurtful. No matter how hard I try, I can't forget those words. And it's actually pretty easy to close your eyes and just be back in that moment and on loop almost, effortlessly. You can replay what they said about you or what they said to you or how I can't forget what people have said to me or about me. I can't forget the moments I felt betrayed. Right? It's those moments that seem to be on loop in my head and my heart all the time. I can't forget. I can lose my keys. I can forget where I put my, remote control, all sorts of things I can forget, but I can't forget the hurt. I can't forget the pain, no matter how hard I try. And one of the things that is central to the Christian story is this idea of forgiveness, right? This idea that we all need some sort of forgiveness. We all need some sort of grace. We all need some sort of compassion. And I stand in need of that all the time. But the reality is I can forget lots of things, but when that person said that thing, or when I thought that person had my back, and what they were really doing was positioning themselves so they could get the knife in a little bit easier. You know what I'm saying? Like, I got your back. Those moments are really, really hard to forget. And so forgiveness, a discussion about forgiveness and what it is and what it isn't and what it looks like, is really central for us to become the people we want to be in the world. Because if we want to be people of the way of Jesus, one of the centerpieces of the way of Jesus is this idea of forgiveness, this idea of grace, this idea of compassion. And so today I want to talk about forgiveness. But it's one of those sermons, a lot of my sermons, teachings, talks, stand-up comedy, whatever this is, like what it ends up being a lot of times is just me working out my own junk in front of a room full of people, right? So you guys are kind of my therapist in some ways. And so maybe today you're here and you have no problem with forgiveness. You've just forgiven everybody from the person who cut you off in traffic last week to the best friend in high school who stole your boyfriend. Like whatever, you've forgiven all those people. And maybe you don't need to think about forgiveness because you're a forgiveness expert. And maybe we should give you the microphone and I should sit down. Maybe that's very possible that all that's true. But if you'll just indulge me for the next bit, I'd like to talk about what I need to hear, which is like, how do you begin to forgive people? What does forgiveness look like? And why is it so central? And I got to be honest with you, when you start reading the Bible, how many of you have ever been, you needed the Bible, you started reading the Bible and you were looking for something and what you found was terribly unhelpful? Anybody? Like, you're looking for some sort of comfort and some sort of solace, and you find some passages in the Bible that you wish, that I just wish that weren't in there. Anybody ever had that happen? So I want to show you a couple texts that I just wish weren't in the Bible on some days. And this is part of the Lord's Prayer, where Jesus is teaching his disciples to pray, the Our Father. Forgive us, this is part of the prayer, forgive us for the ways we have wronged you, just as we also forgive those who have wronged us. And at the end, Jesus says this, if you forgive others their sins, your heavenly Father will forgive you. But if you don't forgive others, neither will your Father forgive your sins. Right? Right? I mean, when you read that verse, like, ooh. I mean, if you take this just on face value, you don't think about it anymore. What is Jesus saying? If you don't forgive other human beings, then God isn't going to forgive you. How many of you have heard that before? How many of you live like it's true all the time? Notice Mark chapter 11. Whenever you stand up to pray, if you have something against anyone, forgive so that your Father in heaven may forgive you your wrongdoings. Now, there's lots of times I stand up to pray or sit down to pray or whatever, and I'm making sure God knows about all of your wrongdoings, right? Like, I want to tell you about the people who hurt me, God. I want to tell you about the other people I know who desperately need you and desperately need grace and desperately need forgiveness, and they really need to extend it to other people. And God, if you could just turn them all into robots and make them apologize to me when I need it. You know what I'm saying? But that's not how it works, right? Jesus says that when you're praying and you haven't extended forgiveness, in some way there's this sort of, when it's wonky between you and other people, it's wonky between you and God. And I just really wish these weren't in the Bible. And I just want to talk about, and I want to come back to these at the end, and hopefully they'll make a bit more sense when we think about it in the context of what is forgiveness. And what I think makes it so difficult is that when we start talking about forgiveness, the need for forgiveness assumes that there's a wound. Right? The need for forgiveness assumes that if you have to forgive somebody, what have they done? They've done something that's wounded you. They've caused you pain. They've broken your heart. They've stabbed you in the back. When you need to forgive someone, it means something has gone wrong. And when you're not the person who's been wounded, it's really easy to go up to people and say, well, you just need to forgive and forget. Right? How many of you have been told that by somebody? Like, you've been wounded deeply, and somebody who's being super spiritual just comes up to you and goes, well, just forgive and forget. How many of you come with a delete button? Right? Do you have a delete button in your brain? You're like, oh, I just need to forget that. No, you don't. And what's interesting is where you placed your car keys, that leaves very quickly. But that person who said that thing to you in the fall of 1976, you can still remember it as if it were yesterday. Why is that? Because hurt leaves a wound. It scars us. C.S. Lewis said, everyone thinks forgiveness is a lovely idea until he has something to forgive. Right? It's easy to come to church and talk about, oh, forgiveness is such a beautiful thing. Let's just all forgive each other and love each other. But then that person does that thing to you, and you're like, whoa, 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 whoa. I don't want forgiveness. I want even. I don't want forgiveness. I want to make them pay. And what essentially happens when you're hurt, when you're gossiped about, when the person you thought would always be there for you isn't there for you, when they stab you in the back, when they wound you, what essentially happens is you're left dealing with, now I have this wound, what am I going to do with it? What am I going to do with the wound? And what we often are told to do is to sort of just cover it up or to get even. There's all sorts of options. But we have to acknowledge, in order to heal, we have to acknowledge the wound. In order to move forward, we have to acknowledge that at some point back here, they did that, they said that, that happened. And as long as I refuse to acknowledge it and speak it and say, this happened and this hurt, I mean, of course, this is in some ways a guy problem, but I think it's a problem for everybody. How many of you know men who would never admit they've been hurt? Anybody know that? Anybody know anybody like that? And that's some sort of like, it's macho thing, but when you come to religion, it happens with men and women both. It's like the super spiritual thing is to be impervious to pain, right? It's the super spiritual thing to say, oh, that didn't bother me. I'm rubber and they're glue, right? That's what you're taught to say in school. And sticks and stones will break my bones, but names will never hurt me. Words will never hurt me. But you know what the problem with that is? Is when we teach that saying to our kids, we're teaching them to stay in their hurt. Because words do hurt. And words do leave pain and scars and wounds. So the process of forgiveness begins by acknowledging there is a wound here. They said that. They did that. I never believed they would say that. I never believed they would do that. Now I'm hurt. And what am I going to do with it? And the problem with forgiveness is it goes against every impulse we have. Forgiveness goes against every impulse in your human evolutionary DNA. It goes against all that. And here's why. Essentially, there are two things that happen to us when we're confronted with something that makes us afraid or something scary. When there's a threat, our survival instinct kicks in, and we have these two polar opposite options to choose from. One is fight, and what's the other? Flight. Fight or flight. Fight or flight. Somebody says something that hurts you. You feel threatened. You feel wounded. You feel hurt. You feel in danger. You have these two responses that immediately pop into your head. Are they bigger than me? Because if not, I'm going to fight. Or am I just going to run away? And what often happens is we take some sort of hybrid of the two, right? And we'll talk about that in a second. But we have these fight or flight. Let's talk a bit about flight. Will we choose when we're hurt to run from it? Will we choose to avoid it? Will we choose to repress it? Will we choose to deny it? Will we choose to try just to sweep it under the rug? And if we can just sweep it under the rug, then nobody has to deal with it. And we don't have to have awkward conversations. Does anybody like having awkward conversations with people? No. I mean, some people can't help it. That's just how they talk. But generally, we try to avoid awkward conversations with people. I'm one of those people, though, when I'm nervous. If nobody's talking, I'm going to feel the silence, and it's going to get weird for everybody, right? So we have this sort of like, we can have awkward conversations, but we tend probably to want to just, I don't want to rock the boat. I don't want to say anything, because if I say something, then they're going to respond, and it's going to create this whole thing. So I'm just going to run away. And the problem with flight is that it doesn't deal with the problem. And when you don't deal with the problem, it just gets worse and worse and worse. In 2008, I broke my ankle heroically sliding into third base in a church league softball game. They carted me off the field in an ambulance, took me to the emergency room, and took me into surgery, and they put a plate and like 9 screws in my ankle. And I haven't had a problem with it until recently. And then I realized it hurts all the time. It makes this weird popping sound. There's something moving in there, and it doesn't look like an ankle should look. And so I went to the orthopedic surgeon, and he puts me through all these things. Like, he's moving my foot and turning my foot and asking me how it feels. And he's like, well, here's the problem. One of your screws is loose. This is not new information. Nobody expected it to be the one in my ankle. I have a loose screw, and it's backed almost completely out, and it's causing fluid to build up on my ankle, and so it looks not like a human ankle anymore, and you can feel this sharp thing protruding from it, and it's a screw. And so at some point, in early September, I'm going to go in, and they're going to cut my ankle open, and they're going to take this stuff out so that it can begin to heal and not have all this stuff going on with it. I've been dealing with this ankle pain since December 31st. I was in my front yard. We were loading up some food and things to take to a New Year's Eve party I was going to, and I'm walking through my front yard, level ground, and my ankle rolls, and I just fell. And I thought, somebody's going to be driving by here and think I started the New Year's celebration a little too early in the front yard. And there I am laying in the front yard, and my ankle was killing me. And it's hurt since December 31st. And it was only a couple weeks ago that I was complaining about it enough that my wife said, you know, you could just go to the doctor. And I had this revelation as I'm sitting with this new surgeon, because my surgeon retired, and I'm sitting with this new surgeon, and he says, yeah, it's not going to get better until we take the loose screw out. And I thought, what if I'd waited longer and longer and longer? And then my mother-in-law, who's a healthcare professional, said, I was going to run this race next Saturday, this mud run. She says, you could lose your entire ankle. You could lose your whole foot. So I'm not going to do that now, right? But there's a sense, the longer I ignore it, the worse it's going to hurt, the more disgusting it's going to look to people, and I'm not going to get better. The same thing is true with pain on the spiritual soul level. The longer you ignore it, the longer you push it off, the longer you avoid it, repress it, deny it, when you refuse to speak it and talk about how it hurt, the longer you do that, it's not going to heal. And what's going to happen to you is you're going to become angry, and you're going to become bitter, and you're going to have all sorts of bile and venom to spew on other people. If you've ever met somebody who's just an angry person, just a bitter person, just the kind of person that if they wake up in the morning and the sun is bright and the sky is blue, they just immediately are in a bad mood because they know birds are singing somewhere. You know what I mean? Like, just that sort of vibe from a person. They're just angry. You don't just wake up one day angry. Anger like that, or when you... how many of you have been in an argument with maybe a spouse or a partner or a friend or a coworker or something, and it just goes out of you? What is that? It means you're dealing with something that you've not actually dealt with. And so there's this sense that the longer we avoid, the deeper the wound gets and the harder it will be to heal. Notice this text from Ephesians 4. Be angry without sinning. So there is a form of anger that isn't like the sinful, broken, painful sort of anger, right? It's when you see, how many of you saw the pictures this week of the little boy in the back of the ambulance from Aleppo, Syria? How many saw this week? How many of you saw that and got really, really angry? I have a friend, she's a writer, and on Twitter she said that she just had a baby boy, and she said that every child in this world should have the same safety that my baby boy has tonight. And if you realize that isn't the case for most kids in the world, it should make you really, so there's an anger, right? When you hear about like things like racism or poverty, those sorts of things, it should well up in us this righteous sort of anger that the world isn't how it should be, and it's not okay that the world isn't how it should be. That's a sort of, but the other sorts of anger, what about the anger that comes out when somebody jumps in front of us in the grocery store line, or somebody cuts us off in traffic, or somebody, you know, there's this other anger, and it overflows from time to time, and it can be very painful for us and everybody else, and it tends to come from these things we've never dealt with that just carry around inside of us and don't go anywhere. Be angry, but don't sin. And then the writer says, don't let the sun set on your anger. Don't let the sun set on your anger. I immediately think about the Elton John song, Don't Let the Sun Go Down. Anybody else that just pops in your head? When Carla and I were first married, I really believed this verse was true. And so I decided we're not going to go to bed angry. The problem is she could go right to sleep. And I would sit up all night getting more angry because she was asleep. I learned maybe we shouldn't take every verse literally because sometimes sleeping it off is a good thing. But essentially, you get what the writer's saying here. Don't carry around anger for days and days and weeks and months and years, because when you do, this writer says you're giving the devil an opportunity. The literal translation here is you're giving foothold. You're creating space. The word devil, by the way, means to slander. It has this idea of malice, this idea of trying to do things to harm others. Be angry about things that matter. Don't sin in your anger. Don't go to bed angry, because if you go to bed enough nights angry, you'll just become an angry person. And then do not create space for the destructive, painful sorts of anger that come from ignoring it, repressing it, and denying it. Many of us in this room, I bet, have wounds we've carried around with us for 20 or 30 years, maybe more. And we've never said, that hurt. When they said that, it hurt. When they did that, it hurt. And the longer we cover it up, the longer we repress, and the longer we deny, the more space it creates in us for anger. And not the good, healthy kind of anger, but the kind of anger that just bubbles over and boils over on other people. And when we choose the flight, when we choose to run, then it creates space for that sort of anger. But then there's the whole issue of fight, right? It doesn't seem like we have good options. We can either run and ignore and deny it, or we can stand in there and go 10 rounds, right? Neither one seems really helpful. There's a story in the book of Judges, and they told me this story as a child, which I now, after reading the story as a grown-up, I just wonder, why did they tell me this story as a child? It's a story about a guy named Samson. He had he's an herbal essence spokesperson, and he had really long hair, and he's really super strong. And there's a story about Samson where he marries this, he's an Israelite, he's a Hebrew, and he marries this Philistine girl. If you think about it, if you're a Shakespeare fan, the Montagues and the Capulets, right? Romeo and Juliet. You have these two groups of people, the Israelites and the Philistines, and they hated one another. And Samson falls in love with a Philistine girl. And so he marries her. And he goes away, and he goes back to his, during the betrothal process, he goes back to his hometown. And eventually he comes to see his new wife. And I just want to read some of this text for you. Later on at the time of the wheat harvest, Samson went to visit his wife, bringing along a young goat. Now, boys, if you're courting a woman, you want to make note of this. You always bring a young goat. I don't know why, but it's in the Bible. So it's what you do. You show up for the first date, and you just have a young goat with you just in case you need it. He brings a young goat. He said, let me go into my wife's bedroom. But her father wouldn't allow him to go in. Her father said, I was so sure that you had completely rejected her that I gave her in marriage to one of your companions. Now, if you're Samson, you're like, dude, you didn't tell me. You're with my wife now. That's helpful information to have. And so Samson here has been slighted. There's this social sort of personal slight, right? This was his wife, and her father, because this is an ancient world where women didn't have any rights, where he just says, I don't think he likes you. I'm going to give you one of his pals. And notice what Samson does. Don't you think, this is great. Don't you think her younger sister is even better? This is the worst father ever, right? This is the worst. I mean, she's kind of woof-woof, but did you see her sister? I mean, she is nice looking. Let her be your wife instead. Samson replied, "No one can blame me now for being ready to bring down trouble on the Philistines." So, has he been looking for a reason? No one can blame me now, which means before they may have blamed me, but now I can do whatever I want. So he does what any rational, normal human being would do. He went out and caught 300 foxes. Like you do. He took torches, turned the fox's tail, tied the fox's tail to tail, and put a torch between each pair of tails. He lit the torches and released the foxes into the Philistines' grain fields. Odd. I mean, can you imagine what he would do if you were at a restaurant and you got his order wrong? Like, this is not going to go well. And to think about this, this is like, he's essentially wrecking the entire economy. Right? In an agrarian society, the grain fields are the economy. And essentially he says, oh, you slighted me? Well, I'm going to go find 300 foxes, tie those puppies tail to tail, put a torch in the middle. I'm just going to send up, I'm going to wreck your entire economy. So he burned the stacked grain, standing grain, vineyards, and olive orchards. The Philistines inquired, who did this? Is that really a question you need to ask at this point? Who did this? So it was reported, Samson the Timnite's son-in-law did it because his father-in-law gave his wife in marriage to one of his companions. So the Philistines went up and burned her and her father to death. Samson then responded to them, if this is how you act, because he's been so sane and rational the entire time, if this is how you act, then I won't stop until I get revenge on you. Now, we often, these stories were told to me as a child as if Samson were a hero. Is this the sort of thing a hero does? A hero stands up for truth. A hero stands up for justice. Samson is an adrenaline junkie. Samson is an egomaniac. And Samson is willing to do whatever he has to do to feel avenged against his enemies. If you look back at some of the key lines in the text, no one can blame me now for being ready to bring down trouble. I won't stop until I get revenge on you. And then after the next go-around where he just slaughters a bunch of them, he says this, I just did to them what they did to me. Really? They took your wife, gave her to someone else, bad, but they didn't send 300 foxes through your town, you know, your whole town, ruin your whole town's economy. I just did to them what they did to me. Samson chooses fight. And when Samson chooses fight, his enemies choose to fight. And when everybody's fighting, Gandhi said this, eye for eye makes the whole world blind. And Samson ends his life, again, a story that I was told to me as a child as an act of heroism. He ends up being captured. He falls for another Philistine woman named Delilah. He tells her the secret of his powerful hair, and essentially gets him to go to sleep, and they come in and cut his hair. They gouge out his eyes, and they put him in to work the grain press. And when Samson dies, he's in a temple of the Philistine god Dagon. And he prays this prayer, and he says, God, give me the strength to avenge my enemies. And he pushes the pillars of the temple. And notice this line in the text. So it turned out that he killed more people in his death than he did during his life. And this is a hero. He killed more people in his death than he did in his life. Samson chose to fight. And he bought into what is called the myth of redemptive violence. That when you've been hurt, you can get even. But the way the scales get balanced is through you doing to them what they have done to you and worse. He buys into the fact that he can out-avenge them, out-revenge them. How many of you when you were growing up in school have ever been in a fist fight? How many of you won? You know what's funny about that? Nobody ever says, oh, I got my butt kicked and it was awful. Everybody always wins, right? Because the person you fought probably isn't in the room, so they're not here to tell their side of the story. How many of you, when you got into a fight, when you've ever been in a fight, maybe you didn't even throw the first punch, but they throw a punch, and then what do? You throw a punch, and then they say, you know what? We're even. Let's go have some coffee. No. What do they do? They throw another punch, and you throw another punch, and suddenly you're both on the ground, and everybody has black eyes. Why? Because that's how violence works. That's how revenge works. It's never that you say, oh, gosh, now we're even. Now we can just go on with our day. It's, I've got to do to you what worse than what you did to me. That's why in the ancient world, eye for an eye was sort of a brilliant progressive leap forward. Because if somebody gouges out your eye, you can't cut off their head. But Jesus comes along and says, if you think this is God's ultimate best for the world, to just gouge out eye for eye, tooth for tooth, then you're missing it. What God has been trying to get you to see all along is this whole business of violence is absurd. This whole belief that you can somehow get even is absurd. It doesn't work. It just leads to more pain. It just leads to more suffering. And when we do this, even in our own personal realm, when you just try to do to them what they've done to you, it never really solves the problem, does it? They gossiped about you. And so how many of you have friends that report gossip to you about you? Why do they do this? Does this make you feel good? Like, you won't believe what so-and-so said about you. No, I don't want, why would you tell me? Don't tell me. I don't want to know. Because now when I see them, it's like, But how many of you have this temptation where it's like, they said what about me? Well, let me tell you what she was doing on Saturday nights in high school. She wasn't so self-righteous back then. You know what he was doing? You know the people he was running around? Like, we have this sense, they've said this, so now I have to tell a story that will get back to them, and suddenly we're in this back and forth. And actually, there are different kinds of revenge. Revenge isn't just this sort of, I'm going to walk up to you and punch you in the face. There's active revenge, which is when you spread the gossip, you punch them in the mouth, you do the sort of the active things. But there's also passive revenge. There are people in my world who don't like me, which is shocking to my mother, but nonetheless true. And when I'm around, sometimes I'll be walking through the grocery store, and one of those people will walk by, and I'm like, oh, crap. Sorry, that's what I think. I'm going to have to make eye contact with them. And I'm going to be the bigger person, so I'm going to do it. But then when they look up and you make eye contact, but then they do this. How does that make you feel? Really? We can invent electricity or discover electricity or whatever. We can invent all sorts of, we can fly to the moon. But we can't say hi to somebody we don't like in the grocery store? Really? And in some ways, that passive revenge is even more painful than the active. Because essentially what you're being told is you're not worthy of even my acknowledgement of your existence. That ignoring, and I don't even know that the people mean it this way. They could just be meaning I'm a coward and I don't want to even look at you. That could be it. But it comes off in the sense of, I just even kind of wish you didn't exist anymore. And I've been tempted to treat people that way before. Like when I bump into people who have been hurtful and painful and those sorts of things, where there's been sort of an awkwardness in the relationship, my initial gut is, I'm just going to ignore them, and that'll teach them. But then I remember, oh, do you remember when so-and-so ignored you? Do you remember how that felt? Do you remember what it felt like to essentially, for somebody to pretend you didn't even matter? It's awful. And so whatever sort of revenge you're dabbling with, it's painful, and it keeps the pain going, right? It just keeps, it escalates. I mean, I have some expertise on this. I'm from Hatfield, McCoy country, right? You do not mess with a pig back there, because when you do, it launches a war where all sorts of people get killed, and they don't even know why they're doing it anymore. Back, you know, I was a lit major. Back to Shakespeare. Why did Romeo and Juliet's families have the... Because there was this word that was spoken once in the past that nobody even remembered anymore. Have you ever been in the middle of it with somebody and you just hate them and they hate you and you're... And somebody says, well, what happened between the two of you? And you're like, I don't know, but I know I don't like them. And our families never liked them. And we're never going to like them. But revenge is always ugly. Passive revenge, active revenge is always ugly. The story of Samson moves from a social slight to destroying their economy, to the killing of his wife and her father, to the killing of a few Philistines, to killing 1,000 Philistines, to the killing of Samson and untold Philistines. Do you see the progression? It starts out as a slight, but it ends up being essentially this big bloodbath that could have been completely avoided. Can you imagine if instead of tying foxes together, Samson would have said, can we all just sit down and have a conversation about my feelings? Can we just talk about this? Because I feel like you've betrayed me. I feel like I've been wounded here. And I really, but instead, he ends up standing on a heap of Philistines with the jawbone of a donkey saying, now this feels right. And then the reality about forgiveness is this. Forgiveness is not a feeling. It's ultimately a choice. Forgiveness isn't a feeling. Forgiveness doesn't mean that you have a good feeling about the person who hurt you. There are people who have wounded you. There are people in this world who have been so abused by another human being that the idea that they would have a good feeling about that human being, it's not only ridiculous, but it essentially would be expecting an abused victim to feel good about their abuser. That is an injustice. Right? Saying to a victim of abuse, you just need to forgive and forget. It's ridiculous. So forgiveness isn't ultimately a feeling. It's a choice. Forgiveness isn't, by the way, condoning. It isn't saying, and this is some of the reasons we have trouble forgiving. We don't want it to feel like we're saying what you said, what you did, that betrayal, that gossip, that rumor, what you said to me, that's okay. Because it's not okay. So one of the ways we try to get through an awkward moment is when somebody says, I'm sorry, we go, oh, it's okay. When what we really mean is, actually, it's not okay. It's not okay at all. What you did is wrong. And I'm choosing to forgive you. You see the difference? Forgiveness isn't condoning. Forgiveness isn't forgetting, right? I mean, we do not come from the factory with a delete button. We have a really, really brilliant knack for remembering every bad thing anybody's ever said to us. There was this one time early in being a pastor, I kept an email folder that said encouragement, and I kept an email folder that said not encouragement, and I would put really nice emails in one and not nice emails in the other. And then once a few years ago, I opened up the not encouragement folder like an idiot, and I started reading these old emails, and I was like, I've got to get rid of the not encouragement folder. Actually, because I remembered them all pretty much word for word anyway. All right, forgiveness can't always be forgetting. And actually, if you forget that that person can't be trusted because they have their toxic personality and they're an abuser, if you forget that, then you're going to be hurt again and again and again and again and again. Forgiveness isn't always reconciling. It takes two people to reconcile. Reconcile, by the way, means to bring peace where there wasn't peace. It takes two for that. And there are some people that are so toxic, you don't need to reconcile with them. You need boundaries. You need to say to them, don't call me and I won't call you. You may need to live in a different zip code. You may need to have a restraining order. It may need to be a person that if you see them going in the same store you are, you just kind of wait until they come out, because being around them could be toxic. It could unravel the work you've done on healing and being put back together. It may mean to forgive them is to create really strong boundaries that say, you can't. My life is off limits. You can't hurt me anymore. And forgiveness doesn't mean that we bypass justice. If somebody's abused somebody, they need to go to prison. And forgiveness doesn't mean you let them off the hook, right? There are legal consequences for the things we do in the world. So forgiveness can take place even if somebody's dealing with the legal ramifications of what they've done. There are some people that have done things, and the rest of society needs to be protected from them doing them again, right? And so forgiveness doesn't have anything to do with bypassing sort of, maybe if they've been an abuser, they need to go and spend some time, like, in jail. That's a real thing. Henry Nouwen says this, though, about forgiveness. To forgive another person from the hurt heart is an act of liberation. We set that person free from the negative bonds that exist between us. We say, I no longer hold your offense against you. But there is more. We also free ourselves from the burden of being the offended one. As long as we do not forgive those who have wounded us, we carry them with us, or worse, pull them as a heavy load. The great temptation is to cling in anger to our enemies and then define ourselves as being offended and wounded by them. One of the things I've learned in life is that when I spend my time thinking about the people who've hurt me, I'm letting them live in my head and heart rent-free. And I also realize that the people who have hurt me are not going around going, gosh, we really hurt Josh. I feel really bad about that. They just aren't. And yet here I am obsessing over. There's this one person in particular who several years ago said some really painful things, and it's been my life's mission to somehow bring reconciliation to that. And every time I've tried, I've been kicked in the teeth again and again and again. There was this moment where I just realized, gosh, why do I keep going back for more when what I need to work on is not reconciliation, because that's toxic. I need to work on forgiving this person so that I'm not carrying him around as a heavy load, so I'm not letting him live in my head and my heart rent free, so that I can actually begin to move forward and heal and not be defined as the victim of that anymore. Forgiveness isn't just about essentially letting somebody else go free. Forgiveness is about letting yourself go free. Forgiveness is an act of liberation. Forgiveness says, I'm not going to be defined by what you said or what you did anymore. I'm not going to let you control my life and my thoughts and my feelings. I'm done. And I've also found that forgiveness is not a one-time thing. It's a journey. There are some days when I could bump into people who've hurt me and I could give them a hug and I could tell them how good it was to see them. And there are some days when I just want to run over them with my grocery cart. Both are valid emotions. There's space for both. And the reality is that there are some people who every time I see them, every time their name pops up, every time somebody says, did you see what so-and-so said on Facebook? No, I blocked them years ago. And you don't have to. Every time, we have to make a choice. I'm going to allow what they did to make me bitter, or I'm going to step back, allow the Spirit of God to heal me, and I'm going to move forward and be better than I was before. Sometimes you have to forgive every moment of every day. And some days it's a lot easier, isn't it? Because you and I, we aren't robots. You and I are living, breathing human beings with emotions and feelings, and all those things matter. So I meant to bring something with me this morning, but I forgot it. Shock! But the first time I ever went snorkeling was in my first year in the Dominican Republic with our mission team. And it was 2013, I guess, and we got to go out snorkeling on the last day there. We go to a beach, and it was really, really beautiful. And I remember putting on the snorkeling gear and just wondering, how does this really work? Because I just felt like you had to think way too hard about it. But I got out there in the water, and it's amazing the things, because the water in the Caribbean is so crystal clear. It's amazing the things you can see, all sorts of sea urchins and these cool fish and all this. But there's this one thing about a snorkel, is if you go underwater, before when you come up, you have to blow out before you can breathe in, right? And so one of the things I was trying to teach my son, and I have a makeshift snorkel here. And one of the things I was trying to teach my son, because we have a pool at our house, and he's been learning to swim, and he has a snorkel, and he's like, teach me how to snorkel. And if you knew how much water I drank, you wouldn't want me to teach you, but I'm going to teach you. And so one of the things you learn is you keep the top above water, and you sound a lot like Darth Vader. And as long as this is above the water line, you have access to unlimited amounts of air. Have you ever thought about that? Right now, you have an access to an unlimited amount of oxygen. There's no shortage. There's enough for everybody. You don't have to go over and kill that person to get their oxygen. There's enough for everyone. But if you take this underwater, you have cut yourself off from the flow of oxygen that gives you life. And it's not the oxygen saying to you, I'm going to show you. It's that you have created a barrier between the oxygen and yourself, and you can no longer get the benefits of being able to breathe deeply from the air. Let's think about what Jesus says at the beginning, those passages of Scripture we didn't like very much. If you forgive others their sins, your heavenly Father will forgive you. If you don't forgive others, neither will your Father forgive your sins. And whenever you stand up to pray, if you have something against anyone, forgive, so that your Father in heaven may forgive you your wrong. Doings. What if Jesus isn't saying that there's this sort of, God stands there and goes, wait a second, did you forgive that? Then I'm out. If you didn't forgive that person, I'm out. What if we go back to the snorkeling, what's interesting is that the same channel that you breathe out is also the same channel you breathe in, right? And you need to breathe in, but you also need to breathe out. And if both things aren't happening, eventually you will die. You have to be able to breathe in and breathe out. There is an unlimited amount of God's grace and forgiveness available to each and every human being. I believe that's true. I don't believe there's this limit where God's like, hey, you reached your daily quota. So anything after this, you're on your own, right? I think like air, God's love and God's compassion and God's grace are available to us if we'll just choose to breathe it in. And yet that becomes a problem because you and I are surviving by breathing in. But then when they say that, when they do that, when they wound us, if we fail to enter into the journey and process of forgiveness, essentially what we're doing is breathing in, but we're not breathing out. And the thing about a snorkel or a neon yellow straw is that in order for it to work, you need more air all the time, all the time, all the time. And in order for that to work, you have to let go of what you previously breathed deeply of so that you can breathe deeply again. What if forgiveness works this way? We're breathing deeply of God's forgiveness. And then when you and I extend what we've been given to those around us, we're exhaling the love and compassion of God, making more space for us to receive more of the love and compassion of God. What if it flows through the same little tube? And that when I breathe out God's grace and forgiveness to others, I'm making more room for me to breathe in God's grace and forgiveness for me. I've found that when people walk around, and I've found this because I've done this, when you walk around with an unforgiveness, when you refuse to deal with the pain and hurt, essentially it can make you feel really, really isolated from the ground of being, from the one in whom we live and move and exist. We always say that God's everywhere. We live, move, and breathe in God, right? God is like the air around us. God's not up there. God's not out there. God's right here. And yet it's possible for us to walk around with such a blockage in our snorkel that we can't access or receive what's right here. And it makes us bitter. It makes us angry. And essentially it cuts us off from the life-giving flow that is all around us all the time. Jesus, as Jesus is dying on the cross, he prays this, Father, forgive them. But they don't know what they're doing. You think the people who've hurt you know what they're doing? Really know what they're doing? I think sometimes we give people way too much credit. And in one way, they know what they're doing, right? I mean, the Roman soldiers who crucified Jesus, the Jewish aristocracy and religious establishment who colluded with the powers that be to kill Jesus, they very well knew. They're getting rid of a troublemaking prophet. They knew what they were doing. But in a larger sort of bigger sense, did they have any idea what they were doing? We looked at the text last week where Jesus rides into Jerusalem and says, if you only knew what would make for peace, but you just can't see it. The people who hurt you may know they've hurt you. They may be intending to hurt you, but in a larger level, I mean, think about this. The universe is billions and billions of years old. And human life literally is a blip on the radar screen of history. And we walk around pretending to have it all figured out. All the questions have been answered. All the mysteries have been conquered. When the reality is, we just don't have very much idea of what we're doing. And Jesus dying sees his... Now, I don't think if somebody's crucifying you, the next thing you do when you come back is like, hey, can we have coffee? Right? There needs to be a boundary. But here's what I'm saying. Jesus finds the forgiveness. Because Jesus is breathing so deeply of God. And he doesn't want anything to block. I mean, Jesus could have died like every other crucifixion victim we know about in history who died with anger and bitterness and yelling curses at his killers. Jesus dies with forgiveness on his lips. Parker Palmer says this. The cross says the pain stops here. The way of the cross is a way of absorbing pain, not passing it on. A way that transforms pain from destructive impulse into creative power. When Jesus accepted the cross, his death opened up a channel for the redeeming power of love. See, that's why people talk about the cross, right? It's not because, and if you really think about it, when we wear them around our necks, it'd be like somebody today wearing an electric chair. Isn't that interesting? But for us, the cross has come to mean so much more than a way of killing. The cross has come to represent a way of living that is not tied to bitterness and hate, that is not tied to anger, that is not tied to preserving our even our own safety and all that sort. It's a way of life that is about giving. giving up oneself for the betterment of the world. It's about creating space for love. When I look at the cross, I don't think about an execution device. I think about, this is an example, the height of the example of God's love for the world. That instead of retaliating against us, God receives, absorbs, and forgives. To be a Christian on the path of Jesus is to be learning this rhythm of absorbing and forgiving. Not without boundaries, not all those things matter. But you and I get to decide the state of our heart. We get to decide if we carry around bitterness and anger. Or we get to decide whether we'll live freely and abundantly. Whether we'll breathe deeply of the grace of God. And then exhale that on those around us. So today, I want to end with some singing and with some communion. For Christians, communion is a way of remembering and honoring the body of Jesus broken, the blood of Jesus poured, which is also a way of us being reminded of who we're called to be in the world. That Jesus says, I have a cross and you have a cross. And that for us, to breathe deeply of God's grace also means carrying our own cross into the world to display the love of God, the grace of God, the compassion of God, the goodness of God to every human being we come in contact with. So I want to offer a word of prayer. We're going to sing. We're going to invite you to head to the back for communion. Everybody's welcome here. We practice an open table because that's how Jesus did it, and we invite you to the table as well. Let's pray. God, we pray for those